As our nation celebrates the 200th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, America's gay citizens are realizing that we, too, are entitled to certain inalienable rights, such as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So while others may be content to celebrate a revolution of two centuries ago, we gay Americans must rededicate ourselves to a new revolution for liberty. So begins a statement of purpose by members of the Gay Activist Alliance of Washington, D.C., a group who recently sponsored a bicentennial conference entitled Gays and the Federal Government. On this edition of Options, the opening speeches from that conference, concluding with Professor Dolores Knoll, an associate professor of English at Kent State University, and beginning with Professor Martin Duberman, distinguished professor of history, Lehman College, City University of New York. Professor Duberman covered the Air Force hearings against Tech Sergeant Leonard Matlevich for the New York Times, and begins this program with a discussion of the expert witnesses called during the course of those hearings. Professor Duberman's talk is entitled Changing Attitudes in America Toward Gay People.
A trial, of course, even when it's called a fact-finding hearing, is essentially a political and not a scientific occasion. Legal strategy, the pressure of the moment, the eagerness to be helpful, the lack of opportunity to expand and qualify remarks, all of these do encourage simplification and even misstatement in the courtroom setting. Indeed, it seems to me that simplification and misstatement may be in evidence in direct proportion to the witness's humanity, that is, the witness's eagerness to do good and his susceptibility to the pressures of the courtroom environment. At any rate, in reading John Money, certainly it's clear that he knows, as well as any person alive, that hormonal research is in its infancy. Perhaps we should say its prenatal stage. He also knows that any general statement about the effects of hormones on behavior is suspect simply because the available data is not only minimal, but often contradictory. He also knows that hormone levels in a given individual seem to vary with environmental circumstances, that we are, in other words, dealing not with a fixed entity, but rather a fluctuating process. Again, to give one of many possible examples, a study of American soldiers in Vietnam showed a sharp drop in testosterone levels under the stress of wartime conditions. Moreover, as scientist and as writer, John Money has always been scrupulous in warning us of the need for caution whenever we do discuss matters relating to hormonal influence. Why, as a witness, Money forgot his own cautions and simplified his own findings, finally, I think, speaks to more than the pressures of the courtroom climate and the usual vagaries of expert testimony. I think it speaks to a general resurgence in our culture, across the board, but also specifically in our explanations of human sexual behavior. I think it speaks to a resurgence of a deterministic set. In other words, a stress on the genetic, the constitutional, the biological, the innate, the inherited, as the basic units for explaining human personality formation and subsequent experience. This shift in cultural consciousness, and I think it's nothing less than that, is especially startling in a country like ours, which has for so long insisted on the malleability of human behavior and has touted change as a supreme cultural value, indeed, almost as a test of authenticity. It's also peculiar in a country like ours, where for most of the 20th century, we Americans have pioneered in developing those techniques, whether psychotherapy, encounter groups, diets, Arica, Est, techniques designed to persuade us that with sufficient energy and determination, we can and should reshape our lives to accord with the latest blueprints of the good life. Like most so-called revolutions in consciousness, this latest one seems to me less a breakthrough into the previously unknown than a retreat to the recently forgotten. Much is different, the vocabulary, bias on the neural substratum, etc. The units of measurement, neonatal startles in one-day-old infants, the techniques, pituitary graphs. All of these seem to be miracles of modernity. But in fact, this modern mountain thus far has brought forth only the proverbial mouse, or perhaps I should say rhesus monkey, since that's the animal most often used. And moreover, that proverbial mouse has so far been squeaking what I think is a very ancient tune. To explain that, let me do a little historical work here. I think self-conscious theorizing about sex is really only about 100 years old. What's curious and germane to our purposes here is that when that theorizing first began, many of the assumptions guiding it are remarkably similar to those assumptions that again, after something like a 50-year lapse, are rising to prominence both in scientific and lay circles. For example, in the late 19th century, almost all scientists of sex did agree that male homosexuality, women as per usual were almost never considered, they did agree that male homosexuality had a constitutional base. The behavior, in other words, was inborn, it was not acquired. Before Freud, almost no one, and possibly the one major exception is the French psychologist Binet, before Freud, almost no one stressed the possible importance of environmental factors. Beyond this consensus that heredity was at the base, there was considerable disagreement among 19th century scientists as to which constitutional factors were most salient and also which secondary symptoms were the most revealing. For example, among the favored causes of homosexuality were embryonic malformation, degenerated genes, a woman's brain, epilepsy and anemia, climate and altitude, masturbation, an absence of spermatozoa, and the presence of genital nerves around the anus. Among the most telltale symptoms were thought to be a small glands and a smooth rectum, a penchant for dirty books and luxurious living, left-handedness, and an inability to spit and whistle. There was a very serious and prolonged scientific debate about spitting and whistling. Well, as I say, though there were many disputes about the organic and somatic marks of homosexuality, there was a consensus in the late 19th century that male homosexuality was innate. Since it was innate, it could not be cured. And also, since it was involuntary, most of these scientists argued it should not be punished. To that degree, perhaps, it represents a humane advance over what had preceded. What these scientists thought could be expected of the afflicted was that they remain celibate. Should willpower prove insufficient to that task, the afflicted could always turn to such popular devices of the day as the spiked penal ring, guaranteed to discourage any threat of tumescence. Well, perhaps all this sounds far removed from 1975 and the climate surrounding the Matlovich hearings. To my mind, it's not far removed at all. Not only did the hearings demonstrate that the congenital theory of homosexuality is once again rapidly gaining ground in the scientific community, but, getting down to what is perhaps a trivial detail, the government's attorney actually invoked the 19th century remedy. At one point, he asked Sergeant Matlovich directly, "Will you sign a contract never to practice homosexuality again?" Matlovich, understandably, blanched in disbelief and then declined. Had he agreed to take a vow of chastity, I think it's at least conceivable, no more than that, that he would have been then thought fit for, quote, rehabilitation and retained in service. Because there is a clause in the Air Force regulations which the regulations say, essentially, homosexuality will not be tolerated. But there is a clause that says, except under the most unusual circumstances. What Matlovich's attorneys argued at length and with great skill was that Matlovich did qualify under that exception clause. He qualified because of the high level of his past performance on the job. But apparently an unblemished record and uncommon talent do not make for unusual circumstances. Only a contract to be celibate might have, and Matlovich declined to wear the spiked ring. The testimony of John Money contrasted in significant ways with the testimony given by the other leading defense witness, Dr. Wardell Pomeroy, who was called on the fourth day of the hearings. Pomeroy, as I'm sure most of you know, was an associate of Kinsey's and one of the authors of the Kinsey Institute's two most influential books, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male and Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. A man of less intellectual brilliance than Money, Pomeroy's presence was altogether more benign than Money's. He is a warm, rumpled, kind of grandfatherly figure, a man who hesitates before answering questions and even expresses some doubts as to his own answers. Pomeroy's testimony did coincide with Money's on most counts, but what was most provocative was where his testimony did not coincide with Money's. Both men, first of all, did agree on a number of matters, and let me first tell you about those briefly. They agreed that the great majority of homosexuals do not wish to, quote, convert heterosexuals, that they are not prone to molest children, that they stand up as well or as badly as anybody else does under pressure. Also, when asked whether they viewed homosexuality as unnatural or immoral, both men concurred that the terms needed definition. Strictly speaking, Money said, anything that occurs in nature is natural, and homosexuality is recorded among all primates. Money also aptly redefined morality as ideology, namely, the value set and rules of behavior that characterize a given culture at a given point in time. He then went on to concede, and I think necessarily, that in our civilization since Christianity, We've chosen to define homosexuality as immoral. But, he added, quote, society is now in the process of making up its mind whether this long-standing stigma any longer makes sense, just as it has recently made up its mind to take mad people out of dungeons and to stop treating left-handedness as a disease. As I said, though both Pomeroy and Money coincided in their testimony on most particulars, there was one area in which their disagreement was substantial and, I think, significant, and that is over the question of when and how sexual orientation becomes fixed and to what degree it can thereafter be changed. Money claimed to find, quote, a great deal of evidence to support the view that prenatal hormones play a significant role in predisposing later sexual behavior. Wardell Pomeroy found almost no such evidence. Neither man was pressed during the hearings, but Money did voluntarily point to research on pregnant women under stress as indicating one way that hormonal imbalances can be created and later sexual orientation and behavior affected. In line with that, the most publicized and I think the most respected work on the effect of stress during pregnancy has been done by Dr. Ingeborg Ward of Villanova University. She has reported that pregnant rats, that's important to keep in mind, when put under stress, severe stress, which I'll get into in a second, produced male offsprings who mated less frequently than did the pups of unstressed mothers. Dr. Ward has speculated that the process involved here is that the stress causes the pituitary gland to increase production of adrenal hormones, including the so-called weak male hormone AD, and it also inhibits the production by the testes of the more potent male hormone testosterone. Therefore, thereby, according to Dr. Ward, AD during the fetal stage is able to preempt certain chemical resting sites in the brain, this is her terminology, in the pup's brains, which are ordinarily programmed by testosterone. And the result of that is that these pups are later unable to differentiate as normally functioning males. Now, the problems with Dr. Ward's speculations seem to me multiple, and I'm sure all of you have already come up with at least three or four. To save time, I won't attempt to go into all the problems with her speculations. Instead, I'll jump to simply one study or one aspect of this whole scientific debate. One thing that has become clear quite recently, despite some hoopla in the public press to the contrary, is that in adult gay men, there is no persuasive evidence that their testosterone levels are any lower or higher than those of straight men. You'll all recall, no doubt, that famed urine analysis study from a year or two back, which claimed to have discovered wide differentials between gay and straight men. That study received considerable publicity in the popular press. Since then, the study has been attacked not only for its suspect sampling techniques and its inadequate controls, but also because efforts to replicate the study have been wholly unsuccessful. Subsequent studies have shown no differential rates in testosterone levels between gay and straight men. Let me summarize this whole section by simply quoting an anonymous author in Fagrag, himself a senior medical student at Harvard Medical School. As he put it, summarizing all the data on hormonal research, what is really needed is for some good controlled studies in man or some well-deserved silence in the absence of those studies. Now, and this is another area where, you know, I change my mind each time I rewrite the page. But it seems to me, tentatively, this is where I'm at this morning in Washington, D.C., that what does not follow from everything I've just said is that subsequent hormonal experiments may in fact establish that there is a significant or even a controlling role for prenatal hormones in programming postnatal sexual behavior. The possible discovery that hormones or some other aspect of our biochemical or genetic inheritance may be responsible in whole or part for establishing sexual orientation does not, I think, carry any automatically negative judgment. That is, if the society ceases to equate differences with deficiencies. The latter, judgments about deficiencies, are moral judgments, not scientific truths. They reflect culture-bound and transient values, not universal verities. Of course, that hasn't in the past prevented scientific findings from being used as polemical weapons against us. And I think the reason gay people, and perhaps women and blacks too, have been so distrustful of the current resurgence of interest in constitutional differences, hereditary factors, is that they know perfectly well that in the past, such discoveries, again in quotes, for example, the inability of homosexual men to spit and whistle, or the disinterest of the female in sexuality, or the smaller cranial capacity of the black, that all these so-called discoveries in the past have not been spawned by science, though they have always come dressed in the latest scientific vocabulary and have always been endorsed by leaders in the field, but rather they have been spawned by ideology, namely the need to justify and extend the existing pattern of power relationships. Knowing this history of the repressive uses to which previous scientific findings have been put, some gay people have understandably decided that the safest tack for the present is simply to refuse to be drawn into any discussion of, quote, the causes of homosexuality. What I've been trying to argue is that the expert opinion presented at the Matlovich hearings was like so much expert opinion that we have long been familiar with in the past. Or to put it another way, I think societies tend to produce expert opinion that clarifies and consolidates already acceptable assumptions about how the world works. Specialists usually view themselves as pioneers driven by the need to know. They see themselves as fearlessly exploring the frontiers of truth. In actuality, I think the role that they usually play is not to challenge dominant social attitudes, but rather to confirm them. I think only the greatest in each generation, and often to their own surprise and contrary to their own expectations, only the greatest really re-examine experience in a sufficiently original way to unsettle familiar notions. Such people, too, it can be argued, are responding to social cues, but I think they're responding to the microcosmic ones. by which I mean those needs in the culture so new and tentative that they elude all but the most sensitive antenna. In this sense, the innovators, no less than the confirmers, are social products. What differentiates them is the kind of frequencies each is best equipped to tune into. Moreover, it's only with the passage of time that we're able to distinguish with any confidence between approaches that marked a genuine passage to the newness and those that, however novel the packaging, served essentially to rationalize existing arrangements. At this confused moment in time, it seems to me, about all that we can confidently say is that growing numbers of Americans no longer find serviceable the traditional formulas used to categorize sexual behavior and the conventional morality used to evaluate it. We can say, too, that new explanations and norms, at least in the minimal sense of not having been around recently, are beginning to assert themselves. What is much less clear is why the argument from biology, the argument stressed by John Money, one among several competing views, why that argument has jumped into sudden prominence. Why, despite the paucity of evidence, the theory of the importance of prenatal hormonal influence on postnatal sexual orientation has captured in the last year or two so much attention and allegiance. If it is not a case of the theory persuading through the sheer weight of evidence, and I think it is not, then how else do we account for its growing appeal? In trying to answer that, and I will stop with this attempt, I'd like to just step back a bit. Until recently, I think more perhaps than any other people in the world, we have stressed our ability to shape our destiny according to whatever design we deem desirable. This has been true of us, I think, at least since the decline of Calvinism, with its emphasis on predestination and man's inability, and that decline was certainly completed by the end of the 18th century. Certainly during all of the 19th century, and for most of the 20th, it seemed axiomatic that we, meaning white males, that we could become whatever we wished to become. Neither human history, the accumulated force of tradition, nor human biology, the genetic givens, have been seen by us as significant counterweights to sheer human will. Divine intention did for a while, and in certain circles still does seem, to carry weight. But in sending us out to people an empty continent, God had made manifest our specialness and his decision to renovate the world. This is a common view until very recently, and still, I think, common in some circles. In other words, what I'm arguing is that we have been through time both the most optimistic and the most petulant of people. Convinced of our birthright to do as we please, we have treated any effort to thwart our will as nothing less than an affront to nature. That frame of reference, I think, has shifted dramatically in the last decade, most notably under the hammer blow of our defeat in Vietnam, most recently under the prolonged insecurities of recession. We have lost confidence not merely in our ability to renovate the world, but in our ability to control our individual lives. Moreover, the conviction that change is a difficult process and that radical change, a dangerous process, I think has greater currency in our society now than at any previous time in our history. And where pockets of optimism do remain, mostly with the young, It's an optimism tempered by the disillusionment of the 60s and currently narrowed to a concentration on the inner life. Well, now, this is clearly a very large context in which to place a discussion of shifting attitudes toward sexual behavior. But it does seem to me it's the only context that can, in fact, encompass such a discussion. Again, to quote Leonard Matlevich on the stand, "I wish it was true," he said, "that I could choose. I would never have said that I wanted to be a gay individual." John Money firmly agreed. By about age 5, Money testified, quote, "the clock can't be turned back." The other leading expert, Wardell Pomeroy, disputed the critical role of hormones and left the way open for the modification, though not the total transformation, of erotic orientation. In summarizing, I think it is comforting to all of us, gay or straight, to be granted some respite from that relentless American injunction to arise anew, to transform ourselves yet again in response to yet another set of social dicta about what is optimal, desirable behavior. Money tells us that it is impossible for adults to change their sexual orientation. Pomeroy, that it may be possible, but it isn't necessary. Both men are encouraging us, regardless of sexual orientation, to be whatever we are, rather than to become what someone else tells us is desirable. Which means, I think, both men are on the side of self-acceptance and diversity. This seems to me a humane shift in emphasis, away from an inflated sense of self-mastery and a demeaning conformity to social expectations. It also seems to me to mark a profound passage in national consciousness. We may be joining the human race, meaning we may be giving up our inordinate national confidence in will and our national missionary zeal to homogenize the entire planet. We may be witnessing, in short, the belated and very welcome end to American innocence. As with every passage, there lingers in my mind anyway some sense of loss and also some sense of foreboding. When Matlevich heard that the verdict had gone against him, he held up a bicentennial 50-cent piece with the inscription, 200 years of freedom. Not yet, Matlevich said. Maybe someday, but not yet. The question I want to leave you with is this. Can we believe that someday will be soon if we lose entire confidence in the human capacity for self-transformation and reinvention? Think of this question, if you will, without reference to the immediate issue of sexual orientation, for it is meant to transcend it.
The next speaker at the opening session of Gays in the Federal Government was Dolores Knoll. Professor Knoll is an associate professor of English at Kent State University. Her speech is entitled, Through the Looking Glass.
Sisters, brothers, and friends, 4 years ago, I came to this city for a specific purpose, to find a gay community to come out. I did find that community that summer, and when I returned to Kent State University in the fall, I came out politically. My life has changed greatly as a result of those actions. A lot of things have happened to me And I have happened to a lot of things. And people. I'm saying all of this because I would like for you to understand some of the feelings I'm experiencing this morning. I'm quite moved by the fact of being here again in this city where I first encountered gay life and the gay movement. I'm honored but also somewhat awed to be speaking before so many veterans of the movement. But most of all, I'm exhilarated by the thought of being part of this conference, which I see as potentially so significant for the millions of gay people in our country and even abroad. As you know, this is a bicentennial conference, one which has been organized to give us, as American gay people, an opportunity to reflect on where we have been individually and as a movement, where we are now, and where we should be going, particularly in relationship to the federal government. There are several stances which we could take toward the coming bicentennial celebration in this country. The most common reaction I've heard is bitterness. Why should gay people celebrate 200 years of oppression? There's much to justify this kind of attitude. Another approach, also valid, was well expressed by a member of the Kent Gay Liberation Front recently when our group was discussing a theme for our annual Halloween dance, a dance which, incidentally, has become such a popular affair that this year it will be partly funded by the university. He suggested that our slogan be, "George Washington comes out, I cannot tell a lie." The third approach is the one which has brought most of us here today, I imagine. And that is the conviction that we as gay Americans have been denied certain very basic rights promised the citizens of this country by its founders. We are here as an oppressed minority group, which, like other minorities, is now striving for its constitutionally guaranteed civil rights. I'm aware that some gay people argue that we are not a minority because evidence indicates that all human beings are intrinsically bisexual to some degree or another. Be that as it may, and I believe that to be the case, the question is not now relevant. The issue concerns oppression, and there is no question that those who would like to or do live a lesbian or male homosexual lifestyle suffer a great deal of oppression. Some gay people perhaps would object to our meeting here for the purposes we have established, because they no longer have any faith in the American system of government or in the American promise of justice and equality. And certainly, cynicism about the traditional methods of obtaining liberty and equality is justified. 5 years ago, on the 4th of May, I stood by a lilac bush and looked at the blue sky and listened to the sound of 52 bullets being fired 100 yards away. A few weeks ago, after reading an editorial entitled "License to Kill" in the first fall issue of the Kent State student newspaper, I sat in my office looking out the window. My office faces the bus stop for handicapped students. I saw sitting there in a wheelchair, reading that paper, a young man with a red beard and a gentle face. I wondered what he was thinking. He had been paralyzed by one of those bullets, and I can never see him without being profoundly moved. And as you know, last month, a federal grand jury denied his plea for compensation, exonerating all of the accused of responsibility for what happened that day. There is a young woman who has been in jail for almost a year in my home state of Kentucky. She is not there because she has been convicted or even accused of any crime. She is there because she has refused to cooperate with the FBI, a U.S. attorney, a judge, and a grand jury in furnishing information about her friends and associates. How in the face of such injustice can one still believe in the American promise? I do not know the extent to which either of these people has faith in the system, if either does at all. But still, they are models for me. Perhaps it is naive to think that ultimately those principles embodied in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution will finally prove stronger than the bullet, or the wiretap, or the jail sentence. But I imagine that most of us here still do have faith, naive though it may be, in those principles, if not in the system, which so often parodies them. If gay people are an oppressed minority, denied our basic civil rights, what should our approach be to fighting for our rights? How is our experience similar to that of other oppressed groups? How is it different? And what should our relationship to these other groups be? There is no question that the gay movement has been greatly influenced by other movements of the last 20 years and more, particularly by the Black civil rights movement. We have also been considerably influenced by the women's movement. More intangibly, perhaps, but certainly no less real, are the effects upon us and upon the society as a whole of the 10 years of ferment which this country has passed through. Many gay people, having joined in the struggle for Black rights or against the war in Vietnam, suddenly woke up to the realization that we were fighting for the liberty of others, but not for our own. Stonewall is our symbol for this realization, and despite the fact that Stonewall was predominantly an event involving gay males, the first time I walked down Christopher Street, cruisy though it was, I felt as if I were at a shrine. In some ways, though, it may be to our disadvantage as a movement to identify ourselves too closely in our own thinking with other oppressed minorities. My lover has an intriguing theory about this. She believes that the gay movement exemplifies a kind of future shock, in that we think we have passed through certain stages in our move toward liberation, whereas in fact we have not passed through them at all. We think this because we identify ourselves in our own minds so closely with the movements which have made a certain degree of progress, at least in the political realm. This future shock, among other factors, may account for the very early splintering of our sense of unity. In our factionalism, we act as if our major goals were achieved, as if the dangers which attend a gay lifestyle were gone, although in reality, for a vast number of gay people, they have hardly lessened. As a movement, perhaps we are not sufficiently aware of the thin ice that we walk on, though as individuals, we often are still sensitive to the point of paranoia, to the hostility which surrounds us, as is indicated by the comparative handful of gay people who have come out politically. Though we have been influenced by other oppressed groups, the nature of our oppression is in many respects different from theirs. So let me try to describe for a moment, especially for those who may be listening or watching, what we mean when we talk about gay oppression. To gay people, lesbians and male homosexuals, the world most of the time is an alien place, a place where left is right and right is left. What everyone else says is natural, the heterosexual relationship is unnatural to us. What is natural to us is proclaimed by the rest of the world, or most of it, as not only unnatural, but heinous, sick, perverted, queer. There was a time when left-handed people were considered evil. The word sinister comes from the Latin word for the left hand. I've heard that there have been times when left-handed people have been put to death. Certainly it hasn't been very long in this country since left-handed children were forced to use their right hands. In our society, we have now advanced, of course, to the point at which left-handedness is not considered a moral stigma nor a condition to be changed, though the left-handed person still must get along as best she can in a right-handed world. The situation for gay people is far more complex and burdensome, as most of us here know so well. As we grow up, we are taught that left is left and right is right. But sooner or later, we come to the realization, often to our dismay, that our left and right are different from what we have been taught. So we learn to pretend that our left and right are the same as everyone else's in that strange world that is so intolerant of difference. And we may ourselves believe what we have been taught, but in our most secret fantasies, or perhaps only in our own uncontrolled dreams, we pass through the looking glass into another place. A place where our left and our right are natural. We pass into the looking glass house, which is our home, though for a time we may try to deny that fact. For many homosexual people, most of us at one period of our lives, that looking glass house is very small and dark, inhabited apparently only by our solitary selves. I thought I was the only gay person in the whole world. How many times have you heard that statement? I thought I was the only one in the whole world. So we wander through the empty rooms, afraid to call out, to find the other looking glass people, to discover that we belong with them. But if we are lucky enough to stumble across another one in the dark, or courageous and resourceful enough to find the secret panels that will bring us to the other inhabitants of that house, then we are indeed at home. A fire burns on the hearth. The rooms are warm and inviting. But always that other world, hostile and alien, looms up on the other side of the glass. Always there is the fear that the irrational creatures out there will recognize us and move harshly, if not to destroy us, as they once did when they burned witches and faggots, and I suppose we should be thankful for small favors. Then at least to deprive us of our livelihoods, to humiliate, repress, and isolate us as if we were sick beings from another planet who might infect their children, not understanding that we are their children. We are the people you warned us about, as the poster said. And they may try to smash the looking glass itself, our entryway to home. So most looking glass people learn very well how to disguise their true feelings. They learn very well the lesson which that proper and sanctimonious world teaches its gay children, how to lie. You recognize, I'm sure, that what I've been describing is what we in the gay culture call the closet, the secret garden, the protected enclave. For some, the closet may be very large and spacious, clean and well lighted, with pictures on the walls. But finally, it is still a closet, enclosed, limited, and limiting. The looking glass house, cozy though it may be, is also finally too small and confining, bounded as it is by the frame of the looking glass, depending for its very existence on the sporadic neglect of that world out there. Some of us, at least then, must leave that house, come back through the looking glass, and live as looking glass people in that other world. We must change that world so that it is no longer alien and hostile to our people, so that we and future generations of gay people can be free of fear, guilt, and deceit. We must leave our part-time looking glass home and build another home for ourselves in the same world where other people live. The nature of our oppression then differs from that of other minority groups. Given sufficient skill and luck, we can usually pass as non-gay. And because we can so readily pass, many of us, especially those who are white, married, and male, can escape the economic and social disadvantages which ordinarily accompany minority status. So given this fact, why should gays be considered an oppressed minority? I've heard members of an ethnic minority argue that we should not. We should pass. We can pass. So why don't we? We know, of course, that the need constantly to pretend to be other than what one is, the ever-recurring necessity to lie, to be hypocritical, to put up a front, even with one's family and closest friends, constantly erodes a person's sense of dignity and integrity. The psychic damage which such duplicity causes cannot be estimated. It is impossible not to be traumatized to some extent by the fact of being a homosexual in our society. This is oppression. Coming back through the looking glass, coming out of that closet, is absolutely necessary to the achievement of personal and political liberation. This axiom is so fundamental that sometimes we may become tired of it, but we must never forget it. Other minorities do not have to come out as we do. They do not have to go home and tell their parents that they're different. They do not have to worry about losing a job if they are discovered to belong to that minority. They, of course, have problems getting the job in the first place. We are here this weekend, then, as an oppressed minority group, similar to other minorities in the fact of oppression, different in the nature of that oppression, a minority that exists within every conceivable class, organization, and institution in American culture, a group whose sense of community is all too fragile, but a minority group nevertheless that has finally broken the silence of centuries and now asks, no, demands, that it be accorded those rights and privileges promised to the citizens of this country. Time magazine says that though gays should be given their civil rights, a case could be made for denying them occupation in certain fields, such as teaching. What is this saying? It is saying that we should be granted our civil rights, except when we shouldn't. Let us speak with one voice, loud and clear. We will no longer allow ourselves to be slandered by those who say we are corrupt and sick. We will not accept second-class citizenship. We will not come crawling to the seat of liberty begging for leftovers. We are not asking for tolerance. We are asking for repentance and recompense for the infinite number of wrongs that have been perpetuated against us and our people. What does this mean specifically? That's what we'll be talking about this weekend, but very briefly. The first battles to be won on the federal level are fundamental ones, abolishing all laws, such as sodomy statutes or immigration laws, which discriminate overtly against gay people. Secondly, a body of law and policy must be established forbidding discrimination in all areas and allowing gays the same legal status as non-gays. Does this mean the right to marry or adopt children if we wish? Or the right to be included in affirmative action plans and hiring quota systems? They better believe it. A favorite dream of mine is of the day when Kent State Department chair people beg closet faculty members to come out so they can meet their quota. Sisters and brothers, the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution declares that the Congress shall make no law prohibiting the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Today, nearly 200 years after those words were written, we are peaceably assembled here in our nation's capital to petition our government and our society for a redress of those grievances which afflict us and the millions of other gay people who are citizens of this country and of the human race. It is too late now to speak for the countless gay Americans who went before us and are dead. Their silence, for they were alive, speaks more poignantly than we can of the suffering which they endured. We do not know who they were, but this we do know, that they, like us, were part of the very fabric of this nation. And they, like us, were denied those rights described in such ringing terms by the writers of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We submit that we have been denied the right to liberty. We submit that we have been denied the right to the pursuit of happiness. And we submit that some of us have been denied the right to life itself. We too are citizens of this nation. We too are inheritors of its promise, and we will not rest until we too partake wholly of our inheritance. Thank you.
And that concludes this edition of Options. Highlights of the opening session of Gays in the Federal Government, a bicentennial conference organized by the Gay Activist Alliance of Washington, D.C.